dared to invite me to dine in an obscure hotel where I would be sure to get hair and cockroaches in the soup. On the very day of the party, Kipling rocked the world, for he was taken ill with typhoid and nearly died. Catherine would spend the next few months helping to take care of the ailing novelist. Kipling survived the ordeal, but tragically his daughter Josephine perished. He was in such a weakened condition that his wife was forced to hide the young girl's death from him until he was well enough to be able to handle the news. As the newspapers carried daily reports of Kipling's condition on their front pages, the world mourned the young girl's loss, just as they rejoiced with his recovery. Having experienced family tragedy in his own life, Tesla hoped that the death would not impair Kipling's ability to write. "I am delighted Kipling has recovered," Tesla told the Johnsons. "I just hope there will be no evil consequences, except a sorrow, though hard to bear." Philosophically, Tesla added, "It will probably give his works more dignity and depth." Do not thus drift with the mob. I invite you to join me in a month's worship with nature in the high temples of the great Sierra Crown beyond our holy Yosemite. It will cost you nothing save the time and very little of that, for you will be mostly in eternity. John Muir. Another frequent visitor to the Johnson household was the conservationist and poet John Muir, who a few years earlier had taken Johnson on a tour of Yosemite, what Muir called the great creations of the Almighty. On his trips to New York, Muir typically dressed in a season three-piece suit complete with a gold watch dangling from a high vest pocket, but his demeanor was mountain man all the way. 60 years old, still in his prime, his hair was gray and long, and his face adorned with a beard that extended to his navel like scraggy sagebrush. His eyes may have sparked in different directions because of an early industrial accident, but his gaze proclaimed the aura of an enlightened one. Having dined with Muir at the Johnsons during the holiday season, and having invited the naturalist back to his lab, Tesla later told Catherine that he appreciated Muir's contribution to society. "I am always grateful to Muir," he wrote, "for his magnificent description of Yosemite Valley, which I have read through in one breath." A founder of the Sierra Club with Johnson, Muir was, in a sense, Tesla's doppelganger. Muir was a somewhat unkempt naturalist who spent most of his time in the forest, but part of him longed for civilization, and Tesla, ever the fastidious and smartly dressed metropolitan, spent most of his life in the city, but longed for the mountains. A former inventor himself, having fashioned an award-winning bed that toppled the sleeper out onto the floor in the morning, Muir was not opposed in principle to human progress, only to callous obliteration of the precious wonders of the planet. Since Tesla's inventions sought to utilize renewable energy and minimize destruction of natural resources, in that sense, both Tesla and Muir shared a common end. Muir's writings remain his most powerful statement to the spiritual path. The importance of his friendship with Tesla helped support the modern concepts conservation and ecological thinking. Placing it all in perspective, Muir wrote, "Who wouldn't be a mountaineer? Up here, all the world's prizes seem nothing." 22. Sorcerer's Apprentice, 1896-97. Tesla had his rooms in the laboratory on Houston Street darkened, and a current was turned on invisibly. As the group gazed at this, the apartment was filled with a terrific lightning display, with the snapping, crackling sound displacing the reverberation of heaven's artillery, and all remarked the weird and awing effect of the exhibition. His face lighting up and his spare figure vibrant with pride, Tesla announced, "I am producing an electrical disturbance of intense magnitude, which by means of certain simple instruments can be felt and appreciated at any point of the globe without the aid or intervention of wires of any kind at all." New York Journal. One of Tesla's most ardent admirers was Yale student Leda Forrest, who had studied the inventor's collected works the previous semester. "Tesla's writings are the greatest exciters to zealous work and study," DeForest wrote in his diary. His New York laboratory is a fabulous domain into which all ambitious young electrical students aspire to enter and there remain. How I pray that I may equal or excel him, that all this belief in my genius is not idle and conceit. In May 1896, the Forest was able to arrange a visit to the East Houston Street den. Now is the critical point in the curve of my life, the youth scribbled on his pad as he sat on the train waiting for his stop, for I am about to seek work with Nikola Tesla. The expert greeted the novice and gave him a tour, but was unable to take him on as an apprentice. Noticing the dejected countenance on the budding inventor's face, Tesla told DeForest, "I see a great future for you, as you are endowed with a keen mind. You will not need this job to succeed." Tesla wished him well and suggested DeForest contact him again. DeForest would apply once more in the spring of 1898, and probably again in 1900 or 1901, but for various reasons he was never hired. In retrospect, Tesla's decision to reject the talented engineer was unfortunate, for DeForest would soon rise to a premier position as a pioneer in the field of wireless communication. He had a commercial mind, and became a tenacious rival to Tesla's other young competitor, Guglielmo Marconi. Throughout 1896, Tesla applied for and received 8 patents on his wireless system. These were mostly different types of oscillators for generating electromagnetic currents of high frequency and high potential. His first application, specifically in the field of radio communication, was in 1897. His second, remote control, in 1898. Earlier patents on oscillators, dating back to 1891 and 1893, also covered this work, though in veiled form. Over the next 5 years, the inventor's arsenal grew to 33 fundamental patents, covering all essential areas of transmitting electrical energy through the natural medium. As part of his overall scheme, Tesla also began working on perfecting a system of telephotography. His interest could be traced to 1893 and the Chicago World's Fair, where Elisha Gray's teleautographic machine was displayed. But over the summer of 1896, competition peaked, especially when Edison announced his plans to market an autographic telegraph. "I'm getting it ready for you newspaper fellows," Edison said. "And when I get working, all you will have to do is hand your copy to the operator, say in New York, for example. The cover would be shut down and presto. The wires will transmit it letter for letter to the machine at the other end in Buffalo. The wires will transmit 20 square inches of copy a minute and will carry sketches and pictures as well." In attempts to outdo Edison, Tesla told the New York Herald of his own advances. Under the imaginative assumptions that images from the retina could be captured and transmitted, Tesla included this esoteric idea along with a more realistic plan to transmit text and pictures over the phone lines and by wireless. Even today, the facsimile machine holds a special place in our imagination, for something typed in an office in New York can be transmitted instantaneously by satellite or over the phone lines to a receiver in San Francisco, Moscow, or Tokyo. One can only imagine the sense of disbelief facing Tesla as he tried to convince readers that pictures could be sent by means of wireless from one city to another. Even primitive Morse-coded messages had yet to really be effectively transmitted. Nevertheless, Marconi was closing in rapidly on successfully demonstrating his wireless apparatus as Tesla scoured the libraries to study the history of telephotography. Tesla traced early work in inventions that led to the development of the facsimile machine and television to English physicist Alexander Bain, who in 1842 first transmitted pictures by using a grid of electrical wires embedded in wax held firmly beneath a sheet of chemically treated paper. All of these wires could be channeled into one cable and strung to a receiving station, where an identical grid was constructed. If the receiver traced out the letter A, for instance, with an electric stylus, the particular wires comprising the design of the letter would be electrified, and these in turn would treat that area of the paper on the receiving end to spell out the matching character. Autographs and drawings could also be transmitted in the same manner. As the process evolved, pictures could be broken down into a finite number of picture elements so that they could also be dispatched. In the 1860s, this grid was replaced by a single wire through the implementation of spinning discs and perfect synchronism between transmitter and receiver. Tesla's synchronous AC motor helping augment the procedure in the late 1880s and early 1890s. With the development of the photographic process, the first wireless pictures were sent in 1898 by Custer and G. Williams, but the arrangements involved the employment of Hertz waves and were impracticable. In 1892, Tesla recalled many years later, the attention of the scientific world was directed to a wonderfully sensitive receiver consisting of an electron stream maintained in a delicately balanced condition in a vacuum bulb, by means of which it was proposed to use photography in the transmission of telegraphic and telephonic messages through the Atlantic cables and later also by wireless. In 1904, Dr. Arthur Korn, an electrical engineer from the University of Munich, gained the attention of the scientific community when he successfully transmitted wire photos from Munich to Nuremberg. According to Korn, who is often credited as the inventor of the television tube, the apparatus utilized Tesla currents. Tesla notes that once Korn introduced a sensitive place and a selenium cell to vary the intensity of the sending current, the process, which is called the television, advanced a great step. Korn's tube is excited by a high-frequency current supplied from a Tesla transformer and may be flashed up many thousand times per second, thereby attaining the moving television image. Tesla dates Korn's first experiments to 1903. A May 1899 article states that Tesla was working on a visual telegraphy system with the light-sensitive element selenium, thus predating Korn's work by 4 years. It is probable that Tesla was replicating the experiments of Custer and Williams on precursors to the video camera, although Korn, not Tesla, perfected it. In essence, the modern television works in a way analogous to Bain's first 1842 construction. An electronic tube, similar to Tesla's brush vacuum tube, is moved across an entire TV screen in an instant. During its pass over the area where the image is formed, it releases synchronized impulses for each pixel. The position of the beam and its precise sequence of firing are directed by impulses stemming from the broadcast station. Each pass over the entire screen creates a separate image that, when played in sequence, portrays natural moving pictures. Tesla followed the advances in the field of telephotography as they occurred and experimented himself. His first task was to figure out the optimal way to transmit the energy. Having tested the Hertz spark gap apparatus, Tesla found that this device, which Marconi was utilizing, was subject to static interference and involved arbitrary pulsed, damped frequencies that were weak. They transmitted themselves transversely through the air and did not take into account longitudinal properties which were augmented when making use of extremely high potentials and a ground connection. Working out calculations that took into account the speed of light and the size of the Earth, Tesla designed carefully constructed continuous, undamped electromagnetic waves that were in harmony with those of the planet. By 1897, Tesla amassed all of the essential patents for generating, modulating, storing, transmitting, and receiving wireless impulses. In a letter to his lawyer, Parker W. Page, Tesla wrote, "I forward herewith Monsieur Marconi's patent, which was just allowed. I notice that the signals have been described as being due to Hertzian waves, which is not the case. In other words, the patent describes something entirely different than what actually takes place. How far does this affect the validity of the patent?" Clearly, Tesla already suspected that Marconi was utilizing his equipment. In Tesla's first patent, specifically for wireless transmission, number 649,621, filed on September 2, 1897, he discusses the need for a terminal, preferably of large surface, maintained by such means as a balloon at an elevation suitable for the purposes of transmission, and another terminal of the secondary connected to the earth. At the receiving station, a transformer of similar construction is employed. The specification goes on to describe how the wavelengths can be constructed and modified so as to tune the circuits and take into account the natural properties of electromagnetic energy. Having taken into account the size and capacity of the Earth, Tesla had calculated that with a coil 50 miles in length, oscillating at 925 times per second, a resonant relationship to the frequency of light was realized. Since he had worked with exhausted tubes, Tesla knew that electricity traveled more easily through them than through air. Thus he reasoned, if his transmission towers were placed on high elevations, above obstructions and further raised by the use of balloons, the upper atmosphere or ionosphere itself would serve as a means of transmission. Large power stations located near waterfalls would supply the energy necessary for the wireless transmission to this upper stratum. In a separate way, the Earth itself would also serve as a medium. The following passage from the same 1897 patent application criticized Marconi's use of the more primitive Hertzian apparatus. "It is to be noted that the phenomenon here involved in the transmission of electrical energy is one of true conduction, and is not to be confounded with the phenomena of electrical radiation, which have heretofore been observed, and which from the very nature and mode of propagation would render practically impossible the transmission of any appreciable amount of energy to such distance as are of practical importance." Marconi, who was working with Lloyd's of London in ship-to-shore experiments, was using a more trial-and-error method. In July 1896, in experiments with Preece, the Italian had successfully transmitted messages through walls and over distances of 7 or 8 miles. In December, he applied for a patent, which Preece felt was very strong, although he knew the youngster had been anticipated by Lodge and Tesla. The patent was not original, and it did not put forth any new principles. Nevertheless, Marconi was definitely succeeding in the real world, while Tesla advanced in his laboratory in refinements of apparatus and in the theoretical realm. The differences in sophistication of knowledge on the subject are aptly described by one of Marconi's associates, Mr. Vivian. "We knew nothing then about the effect of the length of a wave transmitted governing the distance over which communication could be effected," the colleague stated. "We did not even have the means or instruments for measuring wavelength. In fact, we didn't know accurately what wavelength we were using." Preece's initial work in his study of earth currents and induction effects, generating from normal telegraphic lines in the 1880s and 1890s, led him to realize the strength of Tesla's system. Marconi, at that stage, had no understanding of the role of the Earth in conveying electrical energy. He was utilizing the principle of radiation through the air according to Hertz's apparatus. Without understanding why, he did make use of an aerial and ground connection, but this setup had already been published widely in 1893 by Tesla. Other principles were taken from Oliver Lodge, who was in a patent dispute with Guglielmo Marconi. William Preece was well aware that they had been anticipated, but he could also see Marconi advance markedly while his precursors basically stood still. After Marconi rejected Preece's suggestion that they request the use of Tesla's apparatus, the British nobleman was placed in a conflictual situation. In August 1897, he mailed off a terse dispatch. "I regret to say that I must stop all experiments and all action until I learn the conditions that are to determine the relations between your company and the British government departments who have encouraged and helped you so much." But the die was cast, and Preece became helpless to stop what he knew was a complex form of piracy. He became ill and retreated to Egypt, where he stayed a year. Marconi was also being aided by H.M. Hosier, director of Lloyd's, who, according to one account, succeeded in sending reasonably clear messages through Hosier's apparatus, in one place at least where Marconi himself had failed. Lloyd's also contacted Tesla to rig up a wireless set, ship-shore, in 1896 to report the international yacht race, but Tesla refused the offer, claiming that any public demonstration of his system on less than a worldwide basis would be confused with the amateurish effort being made by other experimenters. Instead, Tesla performed a long-distance clandestine experiment which he told no one about, not even his workers. Sometime in 1896 or early 1897, the inventor turned on his generator to produce continuous trains of oscillations and took a cab to the Hudson River. There, he caught a boat and ferried up to West Point with a battery-operated machine suitable for transportation. "I did this two or three times," he told the courts in 1915. "But there were no signals actually given. I simply got the note, but that was for me just the same." In other words, having brought a receiving instrument with him, the inventor simply tuned it to the point where it began to respond to the oscillations emanating from his laboratory back at East Houston Street. "That is, I think, a distance of about 30 miles," Tesla said. Tesla also considered harnessing wind power, the tides, solar and geothermal energy, and also energy released during the process of electrolysis. If water was separated into oxygen and hydrogen, these explosive substances could theoretically be used to generate the heat to create steam. Working along varying lines of research, Tesla also patented ozone production machines and devised a scheme whereby nitrogen from the air would be electrically separated out and blended with conveyor belts of soil to create a fertilizer machine. "All the agriculturist needs," Tesla suggested, "is to shovel a quantity of loose earth, treated by a secret chemical preparation in liquid form, into the cylinder. An electric current is passed through the confined atmosphere. The oxygen and hydrogen are expelled, and the nitrogen, which remains, is thus absorbed into the loose earth. There is thus produced a strong fertilizer for a nominal price right at the farmer's home." On April 6, 1897, Tesla spoke again to the public at the New York Academy of Sciences. Over 4,000 people attended. With large photographs of dozens of radio tubes Tesla had designed gracing the walls, Tesla set out to explain his advances in Roentgen rays. Certainly the audience was interested in seeing a remarkable device that revealed the human skeleton to a living person, but unquestionably most of them came to behold the sorcerer hurl his thunderbolts. Tesla's world telegraphy system had finally come into clear focus. His plan was to disturb the electrical capacity of the Earth with gigantic Tesla oscillators and thereby use these Earth currents themselves as carrier waves for his transmitter. In 1897, he explained precisely how his world telegraphy system would operate. "Suppose the whole Earth to be like a hollow rubber ball filled with water, and at one place I have a tube attached with a plunger. If I press upon the plunger, the water in the tube will be driven into the rubber ball, and as the water is practically incompressible, every part of the surface of the ball will be expanded. If I withdraw the plunger, the water follows it, and every part of the ball will contract. Now, if I pierce the surface of the ball several times and set tubes and plungers at each place, the plungers in these will vibrate up and down in answer to every movement which I may produce in the plunger of the first tube." There is a peculiar addition to this paragraph. "If I were to produce an explosion in the center of the body of water in the ball, this would set up a series of vibrations in the whole body. If I could then set the plunger in one of the tubes to vibrating in consonance with the vibrations of the water, in a little while and with the use of very little energy, I could burst the whole thing asunder." The water corresponds to terrestrial currents, which are today known as telluric currents, and the plungers refer to his transmitters and receivers. The inventor thinks it possible that his machine, when perfected, may be set up, one in each great center of civilization, to flash the news of the day's or hour's history immediately to all other cities of the world. And stepping for a sentence out of the realms of the workaday world, he offers a prophecy that any communication we may have with other stars will certainly be by such a method. This article, which appeared in Scribner's, also discussed Marconi's successful wireless transmission of 8 miles in Europe. We see in these passages, stemming from 1896 and 1897, that Tesla had already conceived of a total plan for his world telegraphy system, and that it utilized a variety of wireless modes, one being through the upper air strata, another by means of mechanical resonance, which he called telegeodynamics, and a third, and his most important, by riding terrestrial currents. His next plan was to measure precisely the frequency of the planet and construct transmitters in harmonic relations to it. Nodal points could then be mapped out from, say, a wireless transmitter placed at Niagara Falls to precise positions for receiving towers on different continents. For all intents and purposes, no one, except for Marconi, had demonstrated that wireless messages could be transmitted more than a few hundred feet. And success only involved the modest goal of sending Morse-coded messages. Marconi's next plan, which would capture the world's attention, was to radiate the impulses across the English Channel. Certainly Tesla had demonstrated all of the principles found in the modern radio years earlier, but his public demonstrations were held within lecture halls. He had established that he could illuminate lamps from a transmitter placed on the roof of his laboratory on Houston Street to his hotel 26 blocks away, but these experiments were held in secret and were never publicized. The 1895 fire also thwarted his efforts to display long-distance effects. And when Lloyd's of London contacted him, to the dismay of his secretary George Scheff, Tesla rejected the offer to demonstrate his system's capabilities. Tesla, however, was not content with merely setting up a world broadcasting system that, from a conceptual perspective, is superior to our prevailing technology in that it would transmit power as well as information. He also suggested that he could contact the stars, create rain in the deserts, or cause wide-scale havoc. Tesla became the quintessential mad scientist. Through his inventions, the world could be dominated according to whim. The contradictions within the inventor began to pull him in opposite directions. In letters to the Johnsons, he calls himself Tesla, great inventor, and implies that, like Paderewski and other luminaries, he was not a mere mortal. But during his Niagara Falls speech, he denigrated himself. Tesla was somewhat wealthy during this period, but the requirements of his operations were beyond his means, and yet Tesla shunned billing engineers when they sought his aid and voided a royalty contract with Westinghouse, though it was now worth a fortune. In June 1897, it was reported that Westinghouse had paid $216,000 for his patents. As Tesla and his partners Brown and Peck were receiving yearly checks of $15,000 with an initial down payment of probably $70,000, this works out to about $250,000 for a 10-year period. In a letter to Astor, Tesla places the figure at $500,000, but in either case, it was still millions of dollars less than its actual value. By this time, Westinghouse and GE had formalized their Entente Cordiale. This meant that a second gigantic corporation with numerous subsidiaries would be benefiting from Tesla's invention, but the inventor would not receive a dime for it. The electric subway trains would also be implementing the Tesla motors and system, and again, the inventor would get no compensation. Tesla's new plans would require enormous expenditures. Westinghouse was making it clear that his company would not be a source of funds beyond their former signed agreement, although it is possible that Tesla did receive additional revenues for other inventions, such as for his oscillators. At the end of the year, the inventor wrote to his friend Ernest Heinrich, an engineer at the Westinghouse Corporation who also was a novelist. "My dear Heinrich," Tesla wrote, "it is true that I have not been quite well of late. I can assure you that I am physically and mentally all right at present. I have, however, still a little ailment which may be best designated as financial anemia, from which you are yourself suffering, if I am not mistaken. I wish you would remember me to all the boys at about Christmas time, for it is just possible that some of them might feel disposed to send me a token." There were other pressures as well. Tesla was having difficulties with his financial backer, Edward Dean Adams, who was opposing his efforts to promote his wireless enterprise. There was this continuing competition with Marconi, and there were the painful echoes of his Serbian past from Kosovo and his lost youth. His parents and brother were dead, and he was away from his family not just in distance, but also in spirit. In yet another of so many letters sent, sisters Maritza and Angelina pleaded for a response. Tesla had sent funds on many occasions and a copy of his Martin text, but they wanted more. "Remember what your name is and where you come from," Maritza wrote, ending her letter with the customary